This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Political ads are coming to Twitter, but it's good to know why they had been banished until now. I'm David Brancaccio. Twitter is relaxing its ban on political ads. The company says it will allow paid messages that focus on specific causes. To understand this development, we need to review why Twitter stopped taking political ads in the first place. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
Twitter decided to ban political ads in 2019. Twitter co-founder Jack Dorsey was CEO at the time. In his series of tweets, he said this kind of messaging should be earned through retweets, not bought. Dorsey said paying for political ads forces this messaging on users, and he warned of what he called unchecked misleading information and deepfakes. Dorsey said Twitter couldn't say it was working to stop misleading information, but let someone paying for ads say whatever they want. Now, under new CEO Elon Musk, Twitter says what it calls cause-based advertising can facilitate public conversation, so politicians and advocacy groups can run ads in the U.S. as long as they're focused on specific causes. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Now, we talk of stock market returns. Tax returns are a big topic for us here. Today, the $171 billion in returns of merchandise that people in the U.S. are expected to send back to retailers now that the holidays are behind us. That's about 18% of all sales, according to the National Retail Federation, about the same rate as last year. But this time around, it could cost you more to send back that sweater. Here's Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes.
Last month, I bought a cutting board online, but I didn't read the product description that said it was 2 feet long, weighed 16 pounds, and required regular massages with a special canister of oil. That's way too big and nice for the kind of cooks we are and the kitchen we have. So this morning, I packed it up to return it. There's the packing slip. Professional cutting board. That's part of the problem. We needed an amateur cutting board. The board cost more than I'd like to admit, and I'm happy to pay the $10 to return it.
Candidly, I'm shocked that it's only $10.
Sutarita Kodali is a retail analyst at Forrester. She says companies often subsidize returns to keep customers happy, even though her research shows only half of online returns end up back on the virtual shelf.
But in many cases, it's a physical inspection, and if it's not perfect, they'll just often throw it away.
Because, Kodali says, that's often cheaper than repackaging the item and getting it back to a place where it can be reshipped. Mark A. Cohen at Columbia Business School says one solution is more regulations governing where things can go once they're returned.
Because we're paying for this, this is something that's embedded in the calculation that drives their retail prices.
In the meantime, Cohen suggests retailers do a better job with their product descriptions, like really highlighting how heavy a cutting board is, and that consumers actually take the time to read them. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Where are we with mental health support in the workplace, given the stress and burnout felt during the pandemic? Wellness programs and mental health hotlines are valuable, but may not get to the heart of a wider problem. For more, I'm joined by Marketplace's senior economics contributor, Chris Farrell in St. Paul. Hey, Chris.
Good morning, David.
Now, an increasing number of companies and organizations have been taking employee mental health concerns more seriously, especially since the pandemic started, 3 years ago?
Yes. And as you say, you know, employers are aware of these multiple surveys, you know, that show that so many workers are dealing with stress and burnout. For example, LinkedIn's top companies surveys show that large companies really started embracing mental health and well-being programs in 2020. And that was during the height of the pandemic. But subsequent surveys report that providing mental health benefits continues to be a priority, even as the worst of the pandemic is behind us, or at least hopefully.
And for employees who are covered, it does make a difference?
These programs really do make a difference. I mean, they include things like mental health hotlines, remote access to therapists, and even improv workshops. You know, that said, these programs are far from adequate. You know, for one thing, you have to work for an employer that offers these benefits. And for another, you're dependent on the programs management decides are worth paying for. And millions of employees work at companies that don't offer mental health and wellness benefits.
All right. And then there's the common criticism that programs like these are too costly when measured the way that the finance office at a company would tend to break it down.
Yes. Yeah, so before the pandemic, mental, physical health, it wasn't a major theme in discussions about economic growth, dynamic economic growth. And as you point out, you know, most of the concerns revolved around reining in health costs, you know, including mental health. Yet the real message in the pandemic is that you can't have a healthy economy without a healthy population. And there's a report from the consulting firm McKinsey, and it notes that economic historians estimate improved health accounts for about one-third of the overall economy per capita growth in the developed economies over the past century. So investing in economy-wide benefits to promote better health, including mental health, you know, it builds economic resilience.
And we actually have information on how health improvements can translate to higher rates of economic growth.
That's right. I mean, there are several channels. Just to mention a few, the number of people dying prematurely will fall. So the working age population will increase. Fewer workers will retire early because of bad health, and they'll work longer. And most importantly, workers are less distracted by coping with their own mental and physical health issues or the challenges their loved ones are dealing with. That's good for workers, their families, and the economy.
Marketplace's senior economics contributor, Chris Farrell. Always good to talk to you.
Thanks a lot.
And employees at Microsoft have their first labor union. 300 people who do quality assurance at a Microsoft video game subsidiary called ZeniMax Studios will bargain collectively as part of the Communications Workers of America. I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.